Hello, everyone. We are continuing with Thomas Manton on an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of James. Last time we started chapter 2 and with verse 1. So verse 1 was, my brethren, have not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect of persons. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on this time. And he actually goes on with verses 2 through 4. And so I'll go ahead and read those. For if there come into your assembly a man with a gold ring in goodly apparel, and there come in also a poor man in vile raiment, and you have respect to him that weareth the gay clothing, and say to him, sit thou here in a good place, and say to the poor, stand thou there, or sit under my footstool, are ye not then partial in yourselves, and become judges of evil thoughts? And so now Thomas Manton begins, I have put all these verses together because they make but one entire sentence. The apostle proves how guilty they were of this evil from whence he dissuades them by a usual practice of theirs in their ecclesiastical conventions. Now he goes through the words of the verses. If there come into your assembly, the word in the original is into your synagogue, by which some understand their Christian assembly for worship. But that is not so probable, because the Christian assembly is nowhere that I can remember expressed by synagogue, but by church. And in the church meeting, there may be, without sin, several seats and places appointed for men of several ranks and dignities in the world. And it is a mistake to apply the censure of the apostles to such a practice, according to Manton here. Others apply it to any common convention and meeting for the deciding of controversies, establishing a public order, and disposing of the offices of the church. And by synagogue, they understand the court where they judged all causes belonging to themselves. Austin or Augustine seems to incline to this sense for one part of it, namely, for a meeting to dispose of all offices that belonged to the church, which were not to be entrusted to men according to their outward quality, but inward accomplishments, there being the same abuse and fashion in the primitive times, which, to our grief, has been found among us, that men were chosen and called to office out of a respect to their worldly luster rather than their spiritual endowments, and the gold ring was preferred before the rich faith, a practice wholly or fully inconsonant with Christian religion and with the dispensation of those times, God himself having immediately called fishermen and persons otherwise despicable, certainly of little note and remark in the world, to the highest offices and employments in the church, his own apostles. If we take the words in this restrained sense for a court or meeting to dispose of ecclesiastical offices and functions, the context may be accommodated with a very proper sense, for according to their offices, so had they places in all church meetings. And therefore the Apostle Paul uses that phrase, he that occupieth the room of the unlearned, 1 Corinthians 14:16, or as it is in the original, the place of the private person. The elders, they sat by themselves, then others that were more learned than the ignorance, the church herein following the custom of the synagogue, which, as the author of the comment upon the epistles that goes under the name of Ambrose observes, was wont or often to place the elders in chairs, the next rank on benches, and the novices at their feet on mats. And thence came the phrase of sitting at the feet of any one of the disciple, for a disciple, as it is said, Paul was brought up at the feet of Gamaliel. And for the women, Grotius tells us that the first place was given to the widows of one man, then to the virgins, then to the matrons. Now, because they assigned these places preposterously out of a regard of wealth rather than grace, and is said to the rich, sit thou here, or honorably, and to the poor, however qualified, stand thou there, or sit at my feet, the place of learners and idiots, which I would assume is means like those are just unlearned or don't have great knowledge. The apostle does with such severity tax that abuse, to wit, their carnal partiality in distributing the honors of the church. So thus you will see the context will go on smoothly. But I must not limit the text to this one use of the court or synagogue, and therefore, if we take in the other uses of deciding all causes and differences between the members of the church, etc., every passage in the context will have its full light and explication. For the apostle speaks of the judging and of such respect of persons as is condemned by the law, in verse 9, which is an accepting of persons in judgment, Leviticus 19, verse 5. And therefore, I understand this synagogue of an assembly met to do justice, in which thought I am confirmed by the judgment and reasons of the late learned writer, I guess which was Herbert Thorndike, in his book of the Right of the Church in a Christian State, who proves that it was the fashion of the Jews to keep court in their synagogues, and therefore do we so often read those phrases like Matthew 10:17, they shall scourge you in their synagogues, and Acts 22:19, beaten in every synagogue, and Acts 26:11, I punished them in every synagogue, because, as he says, where sentence was given, there justice was executed. And it is probable that, being converted to Christianity, they still held the same course. And it is very notable, which he quotes out of Maimonides, which I believe was a Jewish writer, the Sanhedrin, that it is expressly provided by the Jews' constitutions that when a poor man and a rich man plead together, the rich shall not be bidden to sit down and the poor stand, or sit in a worse place, but both sit or both stand, which is a circumstance that has a clear respect to the phrases used by the apostle here, and the rather to be noted because our apostle writes to the 12 tribes, Hebrews by nation, with whom these customs were familiar and of known use. So that out of all we may collect that the synagogue here spoken of is not the church assembly, but the ecclesiastical court or convention for the decision of strifes, wherein they were not to favor the cause of the rich against the poor, which is an explication that clears the whole context and prevents the inconveniences of the received exposition, which so far pleads the cause of the poor as to deny civility and due respect to the rich and honorable in Christian assemblies. So Manton seems to think that this is more of ecclesiastical occasions of decisions here to not respect persons, whereas in the assemblies, you can actually have something of a respect for persons in some sort of honor where the elders might be seated and maybe the poor or widows are up front and closer or something like that. I believe that's what he's saying. All right, so going on in the words, a man with a gold ring or a gold-fingered man, that is the force of the original word. The gold ring was a badge of honor and nobility. Therefore, Judah had his signet, Genesis 38, verses 18 to 25, and Pharaoh, as a token that Joseph was promoted to honor, took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, Genesis 42. So Ahasuerus dealt with Mordecai, Esther 8, verse 8. The next words, in goodly apparel, this also was a note of dignity, Genesis 27, 15. Rebekah took the goodly garment of her son Esau, by which some understand, and he references Dr. Lightfoot, the gorgeous priestly ornaments which belonged to him as having the birthright. So when the prodigal returned, the father, to do him honor, calls for the best robe and a ring, some marks and ornaments of honor which were put on upon solemn days. But the luxury of aftertimes made the use more common. It is said of the rich man in the gospel, Luke 16:19, that he was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared deliciously every day. The next words, a poor man in vile raiment, in the original filthy sordid raiment, it is the same word which the Septuagint, again the Greek version of the Old Testament, uses in Zechariah 3, verses 3 to 4, where mention is made of the high priest's filthy garments, which was a figure of the calamitous state of the church, where the Septuagint has some Greek words here. The next words, and you have respect to him that weareth the gay clothing. Again, obviously gay in those times meant light or happy or something like that. He lists a Greek word is to gaze and observe with some admiration and special reverence. The next words, sit thou here in a good place or in an honorable and worthy place. And so it notes either the rash disposal of the honors of the church into their hands or of the favoring of them in their cause as before. The next words, stand thou here or sit under my footstool. Expressions of contempt and disrespect. Standing or sitting at the feet was the posture of the younger disciples. Sometimes standing is put for those that stood upon their defense, as Psalm 130, verse 3, if thou shouldest mark what is done, who can stand? That is, in court, as those that make a bold defense. So Ephesians 6:13. Take the armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and when you have done all, to stand, that is, before God's tribunal. It is an allusion to the posture of men in courts. This different respect of poor and rich brings to my mind a passage of Bernard, who, when he chanced to espy a poor man meanly appareled, he would say to himself, truly, Bernard, this man with more patience bears his cross than you do. But if he saw a rich man delicately clothed, then he would say, it may be that this man under his delicate clothing has a better soul than you have under your religious habit. An excellent charity and a far better practice than theirs in the text, who said to him in the goodly raiment, sit, to the poor stand. To the rich they assigned a good place, but to the poor the room under the footstool. The next words, are ye not partial in yourselves? This clause is severally rendered because of the different significations of the Greek word used there. Some turn it without an interrogation in this way, ye were not judged in yourselves, but, etc., as if the sense were, though they were not judged themselves, yet they judged others by these inevident signs. But it is better with an interrogation or a question, and yet then there are different readings. Some say thus, are ye not condemned in yourselves? That is, do not your own consciences fall upon you? Certainly the apostle applies the fact to their consciences by this vehement and rousing question, but I think the Greek word must be here rendered condemned. Others translated thus, have ye not doubted or questioned the matter in yourselves? For that is another sense of the word in the text. But here it seems most harsh and incongruous, or that does. Another sense of the word is to make a difference. So it is often taken making a difference, as in Jude 22, he put no difference, as in Acts 15:9, and so it may be fitly rendered here, have ye not made a difference, that is, an unjust difference, out of carnal affection rather than any true judgment. And therefore, for more perspicuity, we explain rather than interpret when we render, are you not partial? It is an appeal to their consciences in making such a difference. Are you not counterpoised with perverse respects? Many times we may know the quality of an action by the verdict of conscience. Is not this partiality? Does not conscience tell you it is making a difference which God never made? Sins directly disproportionable to our profession are against conscience, and in such practices the heart is divided. There are some disallowing thoughts which men strive to smother. The next words, and become judges of evil thoughts. From the running of the words in our translation, I should have guessed the sense to be this, that by these outward appearances, the meanness or lowness and greatness in the world, they judged of men's hearts, which is here expressed by what is most transient and inward in the heart, the thoughts. But this, the Greek words, is to be taken in quite another sense. The meaning is, you altogether judge perversely according to the rule of your own corrupt thoughts and intentions. Their esteem and their ends or purposes were not right, but perverted by carnal affections. They esteemed outward pomp above spiritual graces, which was contrary to reason and religion, and they proposed to themselves other ends or purposes than men should do in acts of choice and judicature. They had men's persons in admiration because of advantage, and did not weigh so much the merits of the cause as the condition of the persons contending. And so and he's done with the words, going through the words. So from these verses, besides the things touched upon in the explication, you may observe, number one, observation one, that men are marvelously apt to honor worldly greatness. To a carnal eye, nothing else is glorious. A corrupt judgment taints the practice. A child of God may be guilty of much worldliness, but he has not a worldly judgment. David's heart went astray, but his judgment being right, that brought him about again, or back again. Psalm 73, compare the whole psalm with the last verse, it is good for me to draw nigh to God. Moses' uprightness and love to the people of God was from his esteem, Hebrews 11:26, esteeming the reproach of Christ, etc. When men have a right esteem, that will make them prize religion, though shrouded under poor, sorry weeds. But when their judgments and conceits are prepossessed and occupied with carnal principles, nothing seems lovely but greatness, and exalted wickedness has more of their respect than oppressed grace. But you will say, may we not show honor and respect to men great in the world if they are wicked? I answer, there is a respect due to the rich, the wicked, but if it be accompanied with a contempt of the mean or low servants of God, it is such a partiality as does not become grace. More particularly, that you may not mistake in your respects to wicked men, take a direction or two. Number one, great men in the world must have respect due to their places, but the godly must have your converse and familiarity. My delight is in the excellent of the earth. Psalm 16, verse 3. A Christian cannot delight in the converse of a wicked man so as he can in the children of God. Besides that the object in the eye of grace has more loveliness, there is the advantage of sweet counsels and spiritual communion, comforted by the mutual faith of you and me, Romans 1, verse 12. So the Christian, in the eye of a Christian, is more lovely, and they would rather have their spend their time with and in converse with the Christian than the worldly great man. Number two, you must be sure not to be ashamed of the meanest or lowest Christians to vouchsafe all due respects to them. Onesimus was a mean or low servant, yet when converted, Paul counted him above a servant as a brother, Philemon 16. So the messengers of the churches are called the glory of Christ, 2 Corinthians 8:23, such as Christ will boast of. Christ is ashamed of none but those that are ashamed of him. It is glory enough in the eye of Christ and grace that they are holy. Number three, you must own them for brethren in their greatest abasures and afflictions, as Moses did the people of God, Hebrews 11:25. Number four, be sure to drive on no self-design in your respects. Be not swayed by a corrupt aim at advantage. This will make us take Egyptians for Israelites and perversely carry out our esteem. It chiefly concerns ministers to mind this, that they may not gild a potsherd and comply with wicked men for their own gain and advantage. It is a description of false teachers, 2 Peter 2, verse 3. Through covetousness they shall, with feigned words, make merchandise of you. They apply themselves to those among whom they may drive on the trade best, not to the saints, but to the rich, and soothe up them, where there is most gain, not where most grace. Hosea 7, verse 3. They made the rulers glad with their lies. Observation number two, from that, are ye not partial? He urges them with a question. To bring us to a sense of things, it is good to put questions to our consciences, because then we do directly return upon our own souls. Soliloquies and discourses with yourselves are of excellent advantage. Psalm 4, verse 4, commune with your own hearts and be still. It is a hard matter to bring a man and himself together and to get him to speak a word to himself. There are many that live in the world for a long time, some 40 or 50 years, and all this while they cannot be brought to converse with their own hearts. This questioning of conscience will be of use to you in humiliation, faith, and obedience. Number one, in your humbling work, there are several questions proper to that business, as in the examination of your estate, when you bring your ways and the commandment together, which is the first rise of humiliation, you will find the soul most awakened by asking of questions. So he's saying that we have a work of humiliation. We should strive to be humble. And that is by examining ourselves and especially examining our state versus the law. And so he goes on, oh, what have I done? Jeremiah 8, verse 6. Do I walk according to the tenor of this holy law? Can I say my heart is clean? Proverbs 20, verse 9. Then there is a second question. When guilt is found out concerning the rigor of the law and the sureness of wrath, every violation is death. Will God be partial for your sake? His jealousy shall smote against that man that says, I have peace, though I walk in the way of mine own heart. Deuteronomy 29:19. Then there are other questions about the dreadfulness of wrath. Ezekiel 22:14. Can my heart endure and my hands be made strong in the days that God shall deal with me? Shall I be able to bear up under torments without measure and without end? Can I dwell with those devouring burnings? Then there is a fourth question after a way of escape. What shall I do to inherit eternal life? Acts 16, verse 30. Or as it is in the prophet, wherewith shall I come before God? Micah 6, verse 8. With what recompense shall I appease his angry justice? And thus you see the whole business of humiliation is carried on in these interrogative forms. So that was in your humbling work. Number two, for the work of faith, these questions are serviceable partly to quicken the soul to the consideration of the offer of God, as when the apostle had disputed of free justification, he enforces all by a question, what shall we then say to these things? Romans 8:31. Soul, what can you object and urge against so rich mercies? Paul, all the while before, had been but drawing the bow, now he lets the arrow fly. What shall we say? Partly because it makes us more sensible of the danger of not believing, Hebrews 2, verse 3. How shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? If I neglect God's second offer, what will become of me? Thus it is a help to the work of faith. Number three, in the work of obedience, these questions are serviceable, as when a temptation is like to carry it in the soul, it is good to come in with a smart question. It's in Genesis 39:9. How can I do this wickedness and sin against God? So if the heart drive on heavily in duties of worship, offer it now to the governor, would he accept it at my hands? Malachi 1 verse 8. Would I do thus to an earthly prince in an earthly matter? Thus you see, questions are of singular use in every part of the holy life. Be more frequent in them, and in every matter, take occasion to discourse with your own souls. Observation number 3, from that judges of evil thoughts. Evils begin first in the thoughts, Matthew 15:19. Out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, that is, in the front of the black roll. Affections pervert the thoughts, and thoughts stain the judgment. Therefore, when God would express the wickedness of the old world, he says, the imagination of their thoughts were evil, Genesis 6:5. The reason of atheism is blasphemy in thoughts. Psalm 10:4, all their thoughts are that there is no God. The reason of worldliness is some wretched thought that is hidden in the bosom. Psalm 49:11, their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever. You see, then, there is reason why you should go to God to cleanse your spirits from evil thoughts, why you should be humbled under them, why you should watch against them. Isaiah 55:7, let the wicked man forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and return unto the Lord. Mark not only his way, but his thoughts. Trace every corrupt desire, every inordinate practice, till you come up to some inward and hidden thought. There are implicit thoughts and thoughts explicit. Explicit are those that are impressed upon the conscience and are more sensible, or ones we can sense. Implicit are those which the scripture calls hidden thoughts and the sayings of the heart. Though the desires, purposes, actions are according to them, yet we do not so sensibly discern them, for they are so odious that they come least in sight. Many such there are, as this was the hidden thought implied in the text, that wealth is to be preferred before grace, and that made them judge so perversely. It is good, therefore, to wait upon the word which discovereth the thoughts and intents of the heart, Hebrews 4:12, that upon every experience you may refer things to their proper head and cause. Sure, there has been a vile thought in me, that there is no God, that the world is forever, that riches are better than grace, that the pleasures of sin are better than the hopes of life, etc. It is good to interpret every action and to observe the language that is couched in it. Your lives do but speak out these thoughts. Observation number 4, that this is an evil thought that men are to be valued by their outward excellency. It is against the dispensation of God, who puts the greatest glory upon those that are of least account and esteem in the world. It is against the nature of grace, whose glory is not sensible, or we can't sense it again, obvious to the senses, but inward and hidden. Psalm 45:13, the king's daughter is all glorious within. A Christian's inside is best. All the world's glory is in show, fancy, and appearance. Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, Acts 25:23, with much show and fancy. Painted things have a greater show with them than real ones. Nazianzen said, the world is Helena without and Hecuba within, or there's nothing answerable to the appearance, but now grace is under a veil, it does not appear what it shall be, 1 John 3:2. Thus, Canticles or Song of Solomon 1:6, the church is said to be black but comely, full of spiritual beauty, though outwardly wretched and deformed with afflictions, which is there expressed by two similitudes, like the tents of Kedar and the curtains of Solomon. The tents of Kedar, the Arabians lived in tents which were but homely and slender in comparison of city buildings, obscure huts, sullied and blacked with the weather, but rich within and full of costly utensils. Therefore, we hear of the glory of Kedar in Isaiah 21:16. And Solomon's curtains may possibly signify the same thing. Josephus says, or said, that Solomon had Babylonian curtains of a baser stuff and work to hide the curious imagery that was carved on the marble walls. The greatest glory is within the veil. The hidden man of the heart is an ornament of great price, 1 Peter 3, verse 4. And as it is against the nature of grace, so it is against all right reason. We do not use to judge so in other cases. We do not prize a horse for the gaudery of its saddle and trappings, but for his strength and swiftness. That painter was laughed at who, because he could not draw Helena fair, drew her rich. We do not therefore judge it a good sword because it has a golden belt. Well then, if it be against providence and grace and reason, go by a wiser rule in valuing things and persons than outward excellency. Do not think that faith best, which the ruler professes in John 7:48, nor those persons best that glitter most with worldly luster. Christ comes often in a disguise to us, as well as the Jews, to us in his poor members. All right, that is the end of verses 2 through 4. And Lord willing, we will continue on next time. But until then, go in an examination of your own hearts. May we always do that. And may we judge aright of God's children, especially when they are under affliction and maybe abased. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.